Angelic intervention. How many times have you heard incredible stories about angels stepping in to help people? Maybe you've had that experience as well. In a moment, we'll be talking about proof of angels. Stand by for that on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Two special guests for you tonight. First of all, as we talk about proof of angels, Ptolemy Tompkins is back with us. Ptolemy's interest in the afterlife began back in 1990. His research has led him into an examination of the death-centered rituals of the Aztecs and what those rituals have to tell us about our own culture's relation to death. Ptolemy was an in-house editor at Guideposts and Angels on Earth for about 10 years, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Ptolemy, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Looking forward to this. Nothing like angel stories that just get us. I love these. And of course,
everybody likes them.
Your co-author, Tyler Bedos, is with us. Tyler studied criminal justice and journalism at Utah Valley University. He joined the Spanish Lake Fork Police Department in Utah in 2008. And while a member of the police department, he's been awarded an exemplary service award. Now, he also was involved in a miraculous rescue of Lily Grossbeck from the Spanish Fork River back in 2015. Tyler, welcome to the show, and I want you to tell us about this miraculous rescue. What happened?
Yeah, it was, thanks for having me, first of all, but it was very unique. It was a Saturday morning in Spanish Fork. It's pretty quiet, typically, and, you know, I was having some lunch, and I got called to the Spanish Fork River. There was four of us working that day, and we got called to the Spanish Fork River with a car that was upside down in the river. As we got closer, someone said that it looks like there was a hand that was protruding out of the car. We didn't really know at that point exactly what was going on until we got there. We got down into the river and could see a hand that was sticking out. We got into the water and heard a calm woman's voice that said, "Help me, help me." That was when it kind of really amped up everything for us. You got this wrecked car, this crushed car that's upside down, and we were able to get in, and it looked to me like there was maybe possibly two occupants, but we knew someone was alive in that car at that point. So we got together, we pushed the car into its side, and that's when we saw that there was one adult occupant in the front that was clearly deceased and had been for hours, and that was a real blow to us because we heard this clear voice. Kind of that point that I peered into the back seat and saw a child, infant, a seat, and a baby that was submerged underwater at this point. And we were able to have a fireman get down inside, cut this baby Lily out of the car. And she's made a full recovery. She was an infant. She couldn't speak at the time, unconscious at the time. And so that's really where it came about in the end.
And that was a miraculous story, Tyler. It went all over the planet. A dead mother's cry for help for her little girl. How did you feel about that? Do you think that's what happened? I mean, you know that you heard the voice of a woman.
Yeah, at first it was tough. At first, you know, originally it was, I'm not sure what this is, you know. It was hard to really process that. But when I really stepped back after the fact, it was pretty, you know, obvious to me that it was an angel. And that was what's detailed so well in our book, that it was tough to know at the time. But yeah, I mean, when I look at it from now and the angles and the feelings and what occurred, that's what came to.
Could she have been alive and by the time everybody got to her, she died?
And that's one of the big questions, but absolutely not. It was so, the wreckage was so, it was so crushed. And, you know, I've been trained to obviously view bodies and things, but it was, how to say it on radio, but her condition was so poorly. It was from the impact that there was, you know, not a whole lot left of her. And so it was obvious that, you know, she was killed, skin color and things, a long time before.
Amazing. So you've teamed up with Ptolemy, of course, and wrote the book Proof of Angels. Ptolemy, tell us how the relationship between you and Tyler, how did you meet up?
Well, I got a call the morning after, or two mornings after the incident, I guess it was a Monday, from my wife, who works at Angels on Earth and Guidepost Magazines, where I used to work. And she'd just come back from the editorial meeting, the weekly editorial meeting. Actually, it might have been an email. I think she sent me an email with this incredible story. And she said, you know, somebody brought this up at the meeting, and they don't want to run it because it's too sad. And I read the story, and I was thinking, boy, if I still worked at the magazine, that's
the story.
Kind of story I would have taken,
yeah.
Because it has this terrible note of tragedy, which just brings you right down, and then this completely miraculous element, which brings you back up again. And to me, angelic encounters seem very often, in our modern world at least, to have those two components. You have something going wrong, either a little bit or a lot wrong, and then you have something or somebody who shows up, and while perhaps not completely solving the situation, in this case bringing Jenny back to life, kind of breaks a hole in the world and shows one or more of the people who are involved that there's more to the world than they thought. And that's a situation I never got tired of writing about when I worked at the magazines, because I don't know, I think my chief interest as a writer over the years, you sort of start to figure it out after a while, yeah. I'm 53, is that the world we get up and move around in every morning is not the world we tend to think it is in our lazier moments. It's something much bigger, stranger, sometimes more terrifying, but most importantly, more wonderful.
They are the best stories, aren't they?
I think so. And I think the fact that they never, ever stop says something about the power of their appeal to people at large. And I think the reason for that appeal is people recognize something in them. There's something familiar in that uncanniness. And in hearing an angel story, even a tragic one like this, there's something that's empowering, strengthening. It's kind of like a little reminder that the world is not what we take it to be on a dull, rainy Sunday afternoon when nothing much seems to be going on. That's not where we live. It seems like it sometimes, but it ain't where we live.
And Tyler, when you heard the voice, do you think at this point, because it's a voice you'll never forget, that it might have been the angel's voice?
Absolutely. I don't think I'll ever forget, you know, that moment. It sticks to me like crazy. It's the moment. So we're just getting into the water. Yeah, definitely. I don't think that's something I'll ever forget.
But you think it was angelic?
Definitely, for sure.
Like, Tyler, when you first heard the voice, you thought, without question, it was just a woman inside the car, right?
Yeah, when we got into the river and there was this voice, that's what really urged us on. That's really what communicated. And like I said, it was so calming. It was a calming voice. It wasn't like a scream. It wasn't but it was a calming voice to where we thought, okay, someone's in there. And that's really...
And everybody heard it, right?
Yes, all four of us heard it. And that's what really was... Like I say, that really, it was a big downer to turn that car over onto its side and to see that, you know, the mother, Jenny, was you know, had been killed hours ago. And so that was such a real crush to us.
How did she die? Did she drown? What do you think happened?
She died on impact.
Okay, the concussion and the crash killed her right there.
Yes, absolutely.
And the little baby, Lily, of course, in the back, strapped in, car seat probably.
Yep, she's in her car seat just above the water, we figure, for the 14 hours. And the doctors are amazed. They can't believe, how she survived. I mean, what the elements, the cold, the water running through. Yes, she remained dry for the night, but just the cold, cold conditions, hanging upside down.
When you got to the baby, was she alert? What was happening?
No, she was unconscious because
She
what
was.
happened is yeah, when we flipped the car, we actually submerged her for 2 or 3 minutes.
She probably thought she had passed on too.
Yes, it was very tough for us to see. I mean, we saw her eyes fluttering, so I sensed there was some life there. But in my mind at that specific moment was that she had passed away or would pass away like her mother.
So after 14 hours of sitting in that car seat upside down just above the surface of the flowing water, she was then plunged into that freezing water for at least 2 minutes.
What,
I mean, it's
what got her back up again, basically? If she had plunged in it for 2 minutes, why 2 minutes? Why not
Tyler saw
2 hours?
You can see on the video where he says, you know, holy something, there's a baby.
Yeah.
And the emergency worker cuts her out.
So, Tyler, she was in the water, maybe submerged a couple minutes right before you got there. You got there at the right time.
Well, no, what happened was when we pushed this car, because when we heard, you know, help me, is when we couldn't get it. It was so wrecked. It was so crushed. We couldn't open a door with the water flowing. It was too much. We couldn't do it. So that's when the four of we got together. We were able to push this car. I'm not quite sure how.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did you? Your adrenaline must have been pumping, huh?
Absolutely, it was incredible. And so we pushed this car into its side, and that's when we could see, you know, how, you know, Jenny's condition and things. And that's when I was able to peer into the back seat of the car,
yeah.
And that's when I could see the child upside down. So how we got it, a fireman was able to kind of get on top, pry the door open, and go down into the car from the top and just pull her a little head out of the water enough to cut her out of her car
okay.
seat and get her out.
And rushed her to the hospital. And
correct.
Do you think you'll keep in touch with the little baby as she grows older?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I've had some amazing contact with you know, Jenny's family.
Who's raising her now?
Her dad, Devin, is raising her.
Okay. What a sad but at the same time miraculous story.
Absolutely. It's really changed my life.
Jeez, my gosh. And Ptolemy, you know, you've written a lot of books and a lot of stories. How does this one compare?
They're piling up slowly. Well, I have always struggled between, well, I'll put it this way. My desire has always been to write a page-turner that has some of the ideas in it that I really care about, and that's a tough thing to do. I think the only time I really succeeded in doing it was when I worked with Evan Alexander doing Proof of Evan.
I was just with him last month in Denver taping our Beyond Belief TV shows. Great guy, by the way.
Terrific guy, and a wonderful guy for me to run into.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, his story was this. He had this manuscript, which was just this giant whale, and it was all over the place. It had all kinds of stuff in it. And I was tasked with turning it into a book that you'd open and want to keep reading and just not stop. And I worked mightily at that. And somehow or other, along the way of producing it, I discovered that Evan's story was really kind of the universal story. You know, if you read Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, it's the story of a protagonist, you know, usually a man, not always, who's just sort of going on about his business, and he's taken out of this world into another world that he never expected existed. And he has adventures there, and then he's plonked back down into this world.
Yeah.
And he looks around, and he sort of, for a second, he has no doubt of where he's been. But, you know, people talk to him, and he starts to doubt, and he thinks, well, maybe it was all a dream. But then he comes across, he puts his hand in his pocket and pulls out something, or he comes across some little clue, some little reminder that tells him, yeah, you were there, and don't forget, because it's important. And at a certain point, I just discovered Eben's story was that story. It actually happened, but it was an almost perfect telling of that story in real life. And it was one that, you know, clearly millions of people needed to hear it at this, you know, at this point in time.
Sure.
And so I was really proud of that, but this is, my hope is that this is a very fast book, a readable book that, you know, keeps the reader going, but that also delivers a couple of key messages that I think are true and that will stick with the reader when they finish it. So this book comes really close to something I've always wanted to do, because often if left to my own devices, I can get a little bit, you know, recondite and go off into areas that people find a little hard going.
Yeah.
And I tried to keep that at the minimum here, and just to focus on the story. And the story I tell, because the incident at the bridge is over in a few pages, and it would make a fascinating magazine article, but this is a book we're talking about,
right.
So how do you write a book about that? What are you going to do? And that's where Tyler just stumbled into my life, and I started telling his story in the book. And his story in the book turned out to have, in the same kind of way that Evans did, in a different way, the same but different,
mm-hmm.
this story that had this resonance, and it had a lot to tell readers about where we are today, about the spiritual landscape and our relationship or our lack of relationship to it, and what it might mean for all of us. And it was incredible. I mean, it was unbelievably fortunate that I ran into him, because he turned out to be just another perfect protagonist for a book.
Tyler, has this story changed your life?
Absolutely. It's really, I mean, it's something, and I was in such a down spot, and this really, really changed my life, really changed my outlook on life. I viewed life differently, and I'm thankful for it.
Now, Ptolemy, there's a lot of angelic books out there, lots of books out there on angels.
Oh, boy.
I mean, I remember back in my St. Louis Nighthawk days, I picked up a book called The Encyclopedia of Angels.
Rosemary on
Guiley. Yep, that's right.
I believe a co-author of yours. At some
yes, she is, right? Talking to the Dead. So lots of angel books. What makes this one different?
Well,
is it this story?
I tell you, it's it's called, you know, the definitive book on the reality of angels and the surprising role they play in each of our lives. And one thing I like about that title is it's so absurd. It's such a preposterous boast, the definitive book on the reality of angels. You know, Thomas Aquinas, he gave it his best shot. Augustine, he tried. Dionysus the Areopagite, well, sure, he did something. But here comes Ptolemy with the definitive book. I mean, I was fully aware of the absurd braggadocio of calling a book of putting up an adjective like that. And really, I had Rosemary's book, which is just this fantastic compendium of information on angels.
It's a great glossary.
You know, open it anywhere and you can't stop reading. And, you know, many other, it's an enormous subject. I mean, from my work at Angels on Earth, I have one book, which is just simply a catalog of books and articles.
Hold on for a second. We'll come back and talk more about what makes this book, Proof of Angels, so different. And then, of course, it's not just about good angels. You'll find out. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Ptolemy Tompkins with us, Tyler Bedos as well. We're talking about their joint work, Proof of Angels. And Ptolemy, we're talking about how this book is different from so many others in terms of what you've written. How different is that?
Well, as I was saying, the world is full of angel books. There are a lot of good ones. But it's a funny thing about us human beings. If you give us too much information, it can kill the charge of the information. And what I wanted to do in terms of writing, you know, a definitive book, I wanted to make the definitive angel book that just sort of hit you in the face, bam, and made you really think, and then just got out of your way and left you with what I'd said, what the story was. You know, a lot of angel books will have, and then another time in Spain in the 17th century, this woman saw a mysterious figure, and then, and you read and you read, and as the stories pile up, you start to get kind of dulled to them. And I think the, if angel stories have a purpose, it is to genuinely affect our belief about what the world might be. And if we read too many of them and we get sort of sleepy, they don't do their job. And with this story, I thought, I'm going to take this story and I'm going to use it like a tool to sort of break open the reader's expectations and perceptions, and just really put it in front of them and say, you know, don't turn away from this, really look at what happened. And it was perfect for that, because what you have is, I mean, the one of the key scenes in the beginning is when Tyler returns to the bridge after the car has been overturned, after Lily has been trucked off to the hospital, after it has been discovered that Jenny is deceased. You know, like many cops do, when there's an intense situation, they return to where it happened and they sort of sort things out and, you know, get a better picture of it. Because when something like that is happening, I think as Tyler could probably tell you, it's just happening so fast. It's crazy, you know, and you need to get a better handle on it by talking to the other people who were there. So what happened was Tyler was brought back to the scene of the accident after going to the hospital for hypothermia, and the other three cops are there, and they're standing on the bridge looking down over the river. And, you know, I find rivers to be just sort of genuine, generally kind of mysterious places anyhow,
but
looking
themselves
down at that flowing water. And Tyler gets this thing in his head. He sees, now that he's calm, now that the hypothermia has gone away, he got, you know, he banged the back of his head and all this kind of stuff's been taken care of. What comes back to him is that voice. And he has a moment, as he could tell you probably better than I, but I'll tell it anyhow. He has a moment where he thinks, okay, I could mention this to the other three guys, but if I do,
they're going to think something's up.
They're going to think I'm nuts.
Yeah.
Or they'll say, yeah, I heard it too. Maybe I should just shut up because it's crazy. Maybe I should just keep my counsel. And he thinks about it for a second, and he doesn't. He brings it up. Standing on the bridge over the water, he says something like, you know, did you guys hear anything in that car before we turned it over? And one by one, each of the three men says, yeah, I heard it too. And that's the moment where suddenly this experience is no longer just inside his head. It's definitively something that happened to four different people, and not just any four people, but four policemen who, you know, have their feet on the ground every day.
And it's probably affected all of them, touched their lives, all of them.
Tyler could tell you better, but what I liked about that moment was that it's suddenly out. It's real. It's acknowledged as real, and it's going to have an effect of some kind because it goes against our rules of what can happen in life. And I loved that moment where it just suddenly is out and there's no putting it back in the bag. Once the four men acknowledge that they too heard it, there's no saying, oh, you know, it never happened. It happened. Now what are you going to do with it? And then you have the start of a story. You have a start of, you know, what are we going to make of this? How are we going to situate it in the landscape of our world where things like that aren't supposed to happen?
Tyler, the four of you, do you keep in touch, or is this something that you basically have spread away from each other?
No, we've kept in great touch. Yeah, we've all talked about it. We've stayed in contact. There's no denying what we heard, and no one's going to do such because it was so clear to us and it really affected us in such a strong way that there's really no changing that.
Was not the sound of what somebody could assume from a dying voice, right? A dying person. It wasn't, help me. It wasn't anything like that, was
it? Not at all. And like I said, it was such a clear, calming female voice. It wasn't...
again, it was just a calming voice, and it
was it loud?
You know, it was loud enough for us to hear it, for all four of us to hear it, and that's with the running creek river. It's with the, you know, sirens that were coming in the distance and different things, and so we still hear and we all hear it, respond to it.
Might it have been the mother's voice from the other side? The other side being the hereafter.
You know, I mean, it's possible. I believe in divine intervention. I believe in that God has a plan, but I think he sent an angel. I really do. I think he sent, I'm Mormon. I believe in guardian angels. I think there was something there. There was an angel there that day that really was saying, hey, if you guys give up, you know, that this baby's going to die like her mother. And I feel like Lily was needed here, and we were guided right to her.
Okay, so let's talk about why you think, we'll start with you, Ptolemy, other people are so fascinated by angelic stories, because they are.
I think there are a couple of reasons. One of them is that they happen all the time. They're one of those things, you know, that story about, I forget, I think it was in the 18th century, pretty sure it was in the 18th century. People would bring in meteorites and show them to scientists and say, this rock fell out of the sky, what's the deal? And these meteorites were ignored by the men of learning who they were shown to, because they knew perfectly well that rocks did not fall out of the sky. That's an absurd idea. So they would just chuck them away. And that's what we human beings do. When presented with something that's real, that doesn't fit with our picture of the world, we chuck it aside. And we currently live in a world where, I don't always like the word, but supernatural events, events that are more than ordinary, they tend to be brushed aside. That's what you're supposed to do. But they happen with such frequency that there is some part of us that is driven nuts by our not being allowed to take them as a reality. And I think angel stories are a reminder of that reality, and people gravitate to them because some part of them says, yeah, I know the world is like that, except I don't know the world is like that because I'm not supposed to, except I do. And the other aspect of them is that angel stories tend to suggest that they're is something larger than us, which cares about us, and which, you know, God can sometimes, you know, people can have a very close interior relationship with God, but God in our day is a pretty remote word, whereas angels are much closer. They're sort of a manifestation of the divine, of the numinous, of the otherworldly, that shows up right here. Whether it's a person showing up at the scene of an accident and then mysteriously disappearing, or a person who just shows up and says something to you and disappears, It's very close. It's very intimate. It's part of our world, and I think that is, it's a manifestation of a reality that we are starving to acknowledge, but that we aren't always allowed to.
Now, you have also dabbled with some demons that make an appearance in this book. How come? Yeah. What happened?
All I do is dabble. You know, I read other people's books and try to find interesting things to say about them. But I do indeed dabble in demons here. I tell you, when I did Eben Alexander's book, he came along at a point where he sort of rescued me in a way, because I had been tied up with trying to figure out what to do with the story of Joe Fisher, who was a young man, a Canadian, who lived in Toronto and got tied up with a channeling circle. They'd meet every week, and one woman would go into trance and speak with various voices. And Fisher, he wrote a book on, a well-received book on reincarnation. He wrote a book called Life Between Life with Dr. Joel Witten up in Toronto, and he was a well-regarded popular writer on topics of this nature. Anyhow, he started going to this channeling circle, and he started getting more and more pulled into it, and he started to have very specific relationships with the entities who spoke from this entranced woman. He calls her Aviva Newman, but I think that's a made-up name. What happened was these spirit beings who spoke through her started giving remarkably accurate information. One of them was a British World War II pilot who sort of just spat out detail after detail of what his barracks was like in England, this kind of stuff. And Fisher began to realize that he might have been on the edge of, you know, the most important discovery in the history of humankind, genuine proof of an invisible world. And he was totally taken up with this. For years, he spent his entire life involved with this group. There was a spirit woman named Philippa, who we developed a particularly strong attraction to, strong enough that Fisher's girlfriend eventually had enough and said, look, you're clearly dating this invisible spirit entity. I'm out of here. And as you read his book, it's called Hungry Ghosts, later reissued as The Siren Call of Hungry Ghosts, you have this experience of accompanying this young man as he is driven slowly crazy. And soon after the second edition of the book came out, he killed himself. He jumped off a cliff in the country just outside Toronto near a cabin where he lived. And I was completely fascinated with this story because my feeling is that we need to be shown the reality of what Black Elk, the Sioux medicine man, called the world behind the world. We're desperate to be shown the reality of this world,
whether we want to or not, I guess.
Well, by means positive or negative, because when you live in a partial reality, you're never going to be totally happy. You're never going to be, if you're not whole, you're not happy. And you're not whole if you're living in half a world. I think not only does the invisible world exist, there's a whole part of us which is in constant contact with it. Freud called it the unconscious. Jung made it a more sophisticated term. There's a part of us that completely knows that world is there. We have a number of sort of personalities within us which deal with that world. We're immersed in it all the time, but in our daylight hours, we go around pretending it doesn't exist, and the only thing that exists is the Starbucks and the street beneath our feet and, bills to pay and all that kind of stuff, and there's nothing else. And that is a point of view which I believe is killing to the spirit. And we all suffer to a degree from this. And the situation needs to be changed. And what's interesting about some of these negative books that deal with malevolent spiritual entities is that they can shock us into an acknowledgement of the reality of that world. And even though it's done so negatively, the end result can, strangely enough, be positive, because we have had the borders of our vision broadened, and that's the key thing. We can also be, like Fisher, driven crazy by it, and I think consorting with spiritual figures that are less than well-intentioned is not a good idea.
Questionable spirits. So.
Yeah, of which I think there are many. That's not a good idea. But reading a book about them and being deeply convinced of what goes on in the book, that can be like a really bracing tonic, if you will. It can shake us awake and make us realize, wow, this is really true. And I have to accommodate my understanding to that fact and accommodate my vision of the world to that fact.
And do you think people create their own demons?
I think they can. I think one of the reasons that the subject matter is so hard to study is because science loves hard edges. It loves finding a piece of the world outside to study, bringing it in, putting it on a table, and, you know, taking it apart, naming its different parts, anatomatizing it, and just having it right there in front of you. And in this world of experience and endeavor, you can't do that, because these beings do not just simply exist in the physical world. They exist on a borderline between our world and other worlds, which are not immediately apprehendable, but they're real. A scientist, or I'm not going to say every scientist, but a sort of a materialistically inclined scientist or individual would say, well, that's just ridiculous. You know, if you can't show it to me, if you can't just hand it to me right now and show it to me, then it's not real. But I think it's been proved by this point, in the sort of the march of knowledge, that there are realities that you can't just say, here it is. They're slipperier than that, and yet they're real. This is a psychological reality, a reality of the mind, which is not simply imaginative. It's a reality that we apprehend with our imaginations, with parts of our mind we're not always in complete contact with. And that makes it hard to be exact with, but that doesn't take away from its reality.
All right, we're going to come back in just a moment at the top of the hour, where we're going to take your questions for our two special guests, Proof of Angels. And I'd also like you to share your story. So if you've got an angelic story, an intervention type story, definitely share it with us. Lots more to talk with the both of them about, including, of course, why so many people believe in angels. What if it's just us within ourselves, that little voice we hear? It's not an angel's voice, but it's us tapping into something else. Is that possible? We'll check into all of this in a moment on coasttocoastam.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and email me whenever you want at george@coasttocoastam.com.